This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This is Hemant Mehta, and you're listening to the Friendly Atheist Podcast. If you like what you're listening to, please go to patreon.com/friendlyatheistpodcast. I'm solo here today because I'm doing an interview with someone I think you're going to enjoy listening to. Alice Gretchen is an actress and writer who may be most familiar to audiences from her role as Mads Rybak in the ABC family show The Lion Game. What audiences may not know is that Alice experienced what she calls a painful yet rewarding transition from Christianity to atheism. It led her to create a website called daretodoubt.org, a resource for people leaving their faith. She now lives in Los Angeles and has just published a book about her journey out of religion called Wayward. During the interview, my microphone was not working properly. However, 90% of the talking is from Alice, and you should be able to hear her just fine. Alice, thank you so much for joining me. So I read the book, and it is a fascinating story from your journey from not just Christian to atheist, but like pretty fundamentalist preaching family to atheist. And I'm wondering, without giving away the entire book here, do you want to give a short version for people listening about your religious journey growing up and the kind of tipping point where you realized, okay, these problems that I'm encountering with my family and the religion and the version of it we're practicing, this may not be the way I want to go.
Yes. So, first of all, thank you very much for having me. I was raised non-denominationally Christian. My parents were very emphatic about that we were non-denominational because in their opinion and in the opinion of many of the people that we went to fellowship with, denominations and branches limited what God could do through the Holy Spirit. When we subscribe to a certain sect or a certain ideology, a certain branch, it to them felt more limiting, which to me, the ironic part is that it kind of non-denominationalism kind of became its own very recognizable denomination as a result of that. And it wasn't until I was in my late teens, early 20s, that I sort of realized that the media, the secular media, called our type of Christianity evangelical, which is a pretty broad blanket. But I also feel, to me, how I personally distinguished it was there were two types of Christians in my mind, the ones who thought it was okay to have sex before marriage and the kind that didn't. We were definitely of the kind that did not think it was okay. So that the media called us evangelical for, which confused me because I grew up thinking evangelical was its own denomination and we were not denominational. So it was very confusing.
And you didn't just go to church though. Like your family, almost as I'm reading it, it seemed like you came from an army family where you're moving all the time to all these different places, but no, that's just what your family did as you were growing up because of their faith.
Yes. So my parents were sort of a minority within a minority, like the type of Christianity that we were into, even though it was non-denominational. Other people might also call it charismatic, which is kind of like a niche spinoff of Pentecostalist-based Christianity. It's in brief, it's like the Holy Spirit, tongues praying, like spirit slaying, falling on the floor, laughing, having visions, and projecting prophecies onto people. That was the type.
You made a reference to this in the book too, but there's a YouTube video with Benny Hinn. What's the song?
The Bodies Hit the Floor.
The Bodies Hit the Floor. And that's not a far cry from what you experienced at church as well.
Not at all. Not at all. No, it was very, very demonstrative, very emotional and emotive and very spontaneous. Like, most of the time there was not a ritual of like, we have praise and worship in this time. Then we have a pre-planned sermon from this time. We're going to pass the offering in between. It wasn't so, ritualized. It was very like, let's see what God's going to do today and whatever the Spirit puts on your heart. And maybe that means we're all going to howl like wolves at the moon for the next hour and a half. Maybe it means we're going to like sob and confess our like sexual perversions to each other, to hold each other accountable, you know,
as one does. Yeah.
Do. Yeah. So it was very, very much, very spontaneous, very holy roller revival tent type of Christianity. And my parents, even within that circle, were particularly unusual because what came out of that for them was, in short, my parents were swept into a charismatic movement that would later be known as the Toronto Blessing. And it spread around the world. I read about this in the book. It spread around the world. My family was heavily involved, and it really influenced my parents' faith. And long story short, led them to believe that God was calling them to give up worldly employment, and then eventually even our housing, to trust in God implicitly to provide for us. And my parents called it living by faith, because there's plenty of Bible verses to back up. Jesus says, you know, you have to sell your possessions and give to the poor, and then come follow me. And my parents took verses like that rather literally, even though they took very many other verses a lot less literally and more as symbolically or metaphorically. And
they're hardly alone in that one. Yeah.
Hardly alone. No, hardly. and that's where there's a lot of wiggle room with the Bible and many other spiritual texts, but specific to Christianity, it's like, you can say whatever verse the Holy Spirit is putting on your heart at that time is the one that you should listen to, even if it's contradictory to other verses in the Bible. Which we know there are many. So
I've definitely heard of Christian families, very devout, who might move because they're going to do a church plant, they're going to start something up. But your family basically said, okay, we're giving up our house, we're going to move. But they didn't have a plan necessarily. They didn't even know where you all were going.
No. So my parents had been missionaries when I was a toddler, where they gave up their careers. My mom was a concert pianist and piano instructor, and my father was a police officer in Berkeley, California. My parents gave up their careers to become full-time missionaries in Nepal and Thailand when I was very little. I don't cover that part too much in the book because I barely remember any of it.
Sure.
So the idea of uprooting their lives and giving up certain worldly titles and possessions was not necessarily new to my parents. But yeah, there was a difference. The first time there was a very clear mission directive of like church planting, home church planting. And after the Toronto Blessing, it was much more of a let's follow God wherever he leads, wherever he puts in our hearts. Maybe it's going to be to go to this campground. Maybe we're going to meet someone in this campground. They're going to invite us to stay with them. And so we did for a few months. And then we meet these people and we stay with relatives that we know. And so it was very, very nomadic and God-led, and I say that in quotations, not to be disrespectful to what my parents genuinely believed, because I do think that where they were at that time, for them, their faith truly was genuine. I don't think they were hiding behind God as a reason to avoid having a conventional American life. I think they, or just to indulge their own desires. I think that they genuinely believed they were acting in the best conscience of what they felt God put in their hearts. So
it is a scary thought to know where they're going to say, we're going to go to, let's say, a campground, and like, maybe someone will help us, but you don't know. And that means, I mean, that I forgot how old you were when you all started that particular journey, but old enough to be aware of what was happening and going. But like, that messes with even homeschooling, that messes with having friends, because you're going to maybe pick up and leave them any given moment. So how does that interaction work with your siblings as all of that is happening? Like, you either become really close to them, or you maybe have nothing in common with them at some point. Like, sure. If they're your only friends, you have no option.
Sure. I think we definitely went the former route. I think it made all of us very tight-knit, and we're all still very close to this day. There were five of us, and like you said, we were all homeschooled. I think my very youngest sister is the only one of us who went to public school for a brief stint when she was in high school. I think it was only 1 or 2 years. And I was so jealous that she had a high school experience. But by that point, I was living on my own in LA, having a grand old time. And it all worked out, you know. But it's, but yeah, I think that having my siblings as the constant friends in my life definitely brought us closer. It was a very different experience for all of us. And I addressed this a little bit in the book, that we could all write a memoir about our upbringing, and it would be very different. I think it was particularly challenging for me as the oldest for several reasons. I was 11 when my dad gave up employment, and I was 13 when we eventually also gave up housing. So the window between when I was 11 to when I was like pretty well into when I was 14, I would say those were my middle school years. You might say were the most unstable, the most extreme, you might say. So for me, it was very challenging, but for some of my siblings, it was a great old road trip. You know, you never knew where we were going to end up next. We got to go see things that a lot of kids would love to see. A lot of kids would love to take a road trip across the country and not have school and go from national park to national park and, ooh, let's meet these new friends. And we're going to stay with them for a few weeks and we could just play. And, you know, I think for me, I just, whether it's my biological makeup or just personality type, whatever it is, I just was a kid that needed a little bit more constancy to feel like I was thriving. And I don't think every kid needs that. I remember my mom saying how much fun she would have had if she were a kid and getting to do this. And I think it was baffling a little bit to my parents that I did have such a hard time with it. And it's
when did they realize you had a hard time with it?
That is a very good question. I don't know I could answer for them. I think that there were definitely moments. I can definitely think of moments where they could see, like, you're not having an easy time with this. Why are you just holed up with your headphones on all the time? Like, why aren't you present? Why aren't you, you know? And for me, what it felt like is I would try to tell them, like, look, like I really want a home. I want to go home. And to me, home was in Rockford, Illinois, which was the last stable home that I had. And so I would always say, I want to go home. And then the response would be, we'll talk to God about it because we're just following God. And so it was a very confusing, for me, it made for a very confused emotional makeup of my parents on the one hand encouraging me to not bottle my feelings, to be open and communicative, to express myself. And I would sometimes try, but then the response that I would get to me did not feel like understanding or sympathy or empathy, and certainly didn't lead to any results that I would have hoped for. It usually just made me feel worse. Expressing my feelings often made me feel worse because the response was very, it just felt like a shrug of like, oh, well, you know, like
there was a part in the book where I think you all went back to Rockford for like a short period of time when you were old enough to be like, I'm so ready to go home. Mm-hmm. And then you had to leave again after that. And I mean, moving itself is a hard thing to do when you're at that like early teenage years, to do it multiple times and to go through that. That's rough. I do want to talk about your acting career, but one thing that you brought up is like, you're jealous of your sister for going through high school for a couple of years, but I'm wondering, because the things you have acted in involve school age, college age, like antics and the things that go on at that age, like you don't necessarily have the personal experience to deal with that. So like, I'm wondering, like, you're reading these scripts, you're going through those scenes. I'm wondering, like, maybe your colleagues on set have had some versions of that themselves. And are you the oddball in that sense? You're the one that is like, oh, is this what happened in high school? Or was it like by that time you kind of knew how everything worked?
You know, I'd say most of the time it was like how you were describing. It was very I feel like I've run for prom or homecoming so many times as a fictional character, having never even gone to a prom or homecoming myself.
Right.
In some ways, I feel like I got the best of the high school experiences without having to have any of the downsides, the boredom and the mundane and the bullying and things like that. So I've gotten to play a cheerleader. I've gotten to play the prom queen. I've gotten to play like the troubled ballerina. So it's fun. You know, it's interesting. I would say that most of the people that I've worked with did have a little bit more of a conventional school upbringing. However, it's not uncommon in Hollywood at all for many young actors to have grown up on sets where they essentially are tutored. If you are under 18 and do not have a diploma or GED yet, you are required by law to have an on-set tutor. So I have several friends who were actors since they were children who kind of had like a sort of homeschooled, sort of tutored, part-time actually in school educational experience. So, but most of the time I would say it was pretty pretty, I guess, standard American education, usually public school, sometimes a private school goer. But yeah, it is fun to have those moments of being like, oh, I wonder if this is what it's really like. And then be able to check, like, is it really like this? Are there really cliques? Like, do the gods really sit differently? I don't know. And like, so much of it is not so much.
Well, and you know, people watching these shows, I mean, the reason some of them become as popular as they do is because they shed some sort of truth on this fictional world you're all creating. So kids are watching those shows sometimes and it's like, yeah, I mean, that's maybe an exaggerated version of what actually happens at my school. So someone's getting it. Someone's getting something out of that as they're doing it.
Yeah, and it's one of those, like, is life imitating art or art imitating life?
Right. Too,
because I remember, and this was one of the sections of my book that I had to cut, it was my first day at school. When I was 13, I shadowed a girl that we were, a random girl whose dad we met in a campground. We lived with them for a few days, and they had a daughter my age who couldn't believe I'd never been to school before. And so she was like, Mom, can Alice be my shadow? And so I went with her to school. And I was confronted with so many of the Hollywood ideas of school that I had, because she went to a private Christian school, first of all, I should say. There were uniforms required. There was only like 25 kids in her entire class. And so there weren't really cliques. Like, there it was like,
you don't have a choice.
I had like a brick ivy colored Tudor building and, you know, like swarms and throngs of kids. Like, it wasn't, this was just some small little private school in Michigan. And it was terrible. My first day of school was just the most mortifying, like, uncomfortable, awkward, terrible experience, I think.
Shadowing her was awkward.
Yeah, because everywhere, the reason why it was so awkward for me was because in each classroom that I went, there was this whole introduction of like, oh, who's your friend? Tell us about your friend. And then there would be a Q&A and be like, where do you live? And I would freeze, like, right. Your head's like, we're traveling right now. Oh, well, where do you normally go to school? I'm homeschooled. Oh, well, why are you guys traveling? Because God, and it would just turn into this huge can of worms that would make everyone,
even at a Christian school, that might make people uncomfortable.
Yes, all, you know, interesting, because it was almost like Christians especially had a hard time with the way my parents were living out their faith, because I don't know if it was because it made them feel implicitly, silently judged, like that's how they should live out their faith, or if it was just they were, it's like their God would never call a man to be unemployed and make his family be homeless. And so how can they believe in the same God? But it was almost, sometimes I had the sense that it was almost Christians who objected to my parents' lifestyle more than people who were not in the church or didn't believe in God. It was more just like, huh, interesting family. You guys are really interesting. And some Christians or strangers like just found us all together inspiring. Like, wow, you guys are really walking your talk, and whatever it was.
And so how does one go from that lifestyle to acting? And I remember when I was reading this, I want you to tell that story, but I was waiting for so many shady things to happen. And it sounds like you actually had a relatively positive experience making that transition, getting discovered and going from there. Can you tell us, like, yeah, how did you go from that lifestyle to acting?
Yes. So the condensed version of it would be, I believed that God opened a door for me to pursue acting. And how that happened was, God opened the door for me to start modeling in Colorado. My family eventually sort of settled in Colorado when I was 15. And it was there that I did the homeschool thing and started going to college super young, not because I was smart, but because it was just, that's kind of what you do. You get your GED and start going to college if you're college minded. And I kept getting approached by modeling scouts to do modeling. And I prayed about it. My parents prayed about it. My parents really encouraged me, surprisingly, believing that it was a door God was opening to provide the money for me to go to nursing school. I was set to go to nursing school. I wanted to be a missionary nurse and join YWAM. I had this whole very Christian plan of how my life was gonna go. And I walked through the door of modeling, which eventually led to a talent manager from Los Angeles inviting me to come out to LA for pilot season to pursue acting. And so again, through a magical thinking lens, that's another open door. And simultaneously, there's doors closing for my nursing school. The state of Colorado changed the state nursing requirements to be 18. I was 16 at the time. So that door got closed that year, the same time that
So you couldn't just go to nursing school at the time. Exactly. You had to fill up your time somehow.
Exactly. And it was like, oh, I guess this is in my mind, growing up the way that I did. And in my mind, it was like nothing happened without reason. Everything was either a door Satan was opening or a door God was opening. And you only find out the hard way. And so it was like, I just figured like, okay, well, this wouldn't be happening if God didn't want it to. So I guess I'll go to LA. And my parents, again, were very supportive, also believing that this was an open door that I could walk through. And they were always very encouraging of all of their children to follow their heart. And clearly I've painted out them to be quite unconventional people themselves. So it wasn't, I don't think there's anything us kids could have done that would have been considered too unconventional for them. They were already so pushing the envelope in all of their different ways that a lot of times people are surprised that my very Christian parents would let me move to Los Angeles by myself. I was 17, to pursue acting. And it's like, I get why people might raise an eyebrow at that. But at the same time, my parents were such envelope pushers themselves that it's also not too surprising to me. So yeah, I moved to LA. My mom and my siblings came out here with me for the first couple months until I got sort of settled and it looked like I was going to stay here. I was insanely lucky and I just started working that first year that I was out here and, everything just kind of snowballed from there. And with my faith, it did challenge me. And I write about this in the book. I was very steeped in what a lot of people call purity culture.
I definitely have so many questions about that. I want to talk to you about. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So that there's a little overlap there with my move to LA and the purity culture that I grew up in colliding a lot from the work group that I had to wear, the boys that I had to kiss in scenes, a lot of that. And so I felt so torn the first few years in LA. That was a word that came up in my journals when I was rereading them while I was writing the book. I would write about, I just feel so torn between what I half think God's called me to and also what I grew up believing how he wanted me to live.
I think one thing you brought up is your first kiss was like in acting school and yeah. You felt like you were betraying whoever your future husband would be.
Yes. So I was one of the like ultra goody, goody Christian girls who like not only wore a promise ring and like was deeply committed to not having sex until marriage. I also thought that it would be a betrayal to my future spouse to even have a crush on a boy. And not every teenager in the several youth groups that I attended in my nomadic years, not everyone took it that to heart. I think by nature, I'm just a person that takes a lot of things very literally and very seriously. And so I definitely take responsibility for how I interpreted a lot of what I was being fed, but it was still stuff I was being fed. And I didn't have any, I didn't even observe anything else because I was just very sheltered. So my first kiss was an acting class and I was racked with guilt for it. I didn't even want to do it, but I felt like I had to. Because this is the job that God's called me to. And it's also not Alice kissing this guy. It's my character kissing his character. And there were all these ways that I tried to do.
There's a way to rationalize it if you want yes. to. Yeah.
Yes. And I both wanted to and needed to if I was going to stay pursuing acting. And again, it just didn't look like there were any other open doors for me. So whether it was an excuse on my part or just how my logic at the time worked, it just seemed like this is what I have to do. And this is what goes with it. If I'm a young girl going out for young girl roles, you're usually going to be involved in a love story. So, it was really hard. The language that I had to use, everything about my value system was just challenged right off the bat.
When you start getting, so you were able to rationalize that when you start getting gigs and this stuff is happening on screen to the point that whatever happens in an acting class, no one's going to really see outside of the class. When it's on screen, people will. How did your family react to that, any of that stuff when they're seeing you doing it on screen?
You know, I don't recall if they did have any sort of reaction. I don't recall them sharing it with me in regard to that. Because I think I remember when I started modeling a little bit more out in Los Angeles, I was more worried about what my parents might think of that because some of it was more risque than the acting roles that I'd done up until that point. So that I was more worried about, but I don't recall any sort of major conversations about it. From friends back home, I remember like, oh, how would your future husband feel if he saw you doing this? And my response was like, well, if he's my future husband, God will give him the grace to deal with it, because I still believe that I was being unfaithful to him, but because God asked me to. So
there's always a rationalization. Yes. Anyone can use. So speaking of purity culture, you write a lot about Joshua Harris's book, I Kiss Dating Goodbye, which has been in the news for a few years now, recently, like 20 years after it came out. But I think one of the things you wrote in there is that book, which heavily tells people to do the whole purity thing, no sex until marriage, no anything until marriage. And I think you wrote in there, it scarred your sense of womanhood. And then you started doing the act. I forgot if you read the book before you started doing the acting gigs and the scenes like that. But I was really curious, because on this podcast, I know we've talked a lot about that book and Joshua Harris, but I'm really curious, in the past couple of years, Joshua Harris has distanced himself from the book and basically kind of apologized, kind of left distancing himself from his own creation. I was really curious to hear, what do you think about the fallout and the distancing of that book? Because you get the benefit of seeing that all happen after you've already learned to walk away from all that.
Yes. Okay. So presently, I find myself feeling deeply sympathetic to Joshua Harris today, and I view him as just as much a survivor of purity culture as I was. And I can say that, having also been a quote unquote victim of the purity culture message that his book preached. I feel like I'm definitely aware some people think I give too much grace for that. For me, he was 21 when that book came out, and me at 21 or 2019, around the age maybe he was writing the book, like I just think, how else was he supposed to turn out? Kind of, you know, we all turn out differently, but I have a lot of admiration for him today, for how he's done his best to own up to a lot of the harm that it's caused, and how he has distanced himself and gone through his own deconstruction of his faith. And so that said, yeah, at the time when I was a teenager, that book really did leave some deep scars on my sense of womanhood. But it was biblically based. So that said, as much as I might have found it consolidated all in I Kiss Dating Goodbye, it's still just in the Bible, the OG book of purity culture. and it's there was another book too, and I write about this. I went to a purity conference led by Eric and Leslie Ludi, who wrote When God Writes Your Love Story, which is a lot like I Kiss Dating Goodbye. But that book almost made a deeper influence on me than I Kiss Dating Goodbye, because it reaffirmed Joshua Harris's message when I was a little bit older. I was 15 when I attended the Ludi's conference and read their book. And it seemed to focus more on the, what I interpreted it as, the reward aspect of it. If you surrender your will to God, God will reward your faith with this amazing love story. I know Harris's message touched on that too, but maybe it's just my recollection, but the Ludi's message really hit that for me. So, not sure how much I want to get into too much of spoiler alerts, but I've talked about this before in other podcasts. Long story short, the future husband that I waited for and prayed for and wrote letters to and was completely saving my emotions and body for, that all kind of got debunked when my first year out in Los Angeles, a guy from my youth group back in Colorado also moved to LA. We were friends for a couple months, nothing more. Had quite firmly established that we were not dating because I didn't date. Mm-hmm. Out of the blue one day, just announced that he was my future husband.
Yeah. It was a weird pickup line.
Yeah. It's a very weird pickup line. he was 3 years older than me. He was 20. I was 17. And, you know, he grew up very similarly to how I did. We went to the same church back in Colorado. And so in some ways, I can't really fault him for that pickup line. I do think it came from a very genuine place. However, I felt deeply betrayed, not just by him as a friend, but more importantly by God, because I'd bought into the promise that if I waited faithfully for my future husband, that God would give me this epic love story and I'd be so head over heels in love and we would have the best sex ever. Of course, how would we know? Because we didn't have anyone else to compare it to. But, you know, it was just going to be like a rom-com epic, is what I kind of thought. And that it was revealed to be this guy who I loved as a brother. I loved as a friend. You know, I just wasn't into him that way. But it's so strange to say now, but I just never once even questioned him. I never once even questioned that, like, did God really tell you that? Like it just was so far out of the realm of possibility in my mind that anyone would just say that unless they genuinely believed it. And I do think he genuinely believed it is the sad, funny part. I use the word betrothed in the book, and yes. I use the word betrothed in my journals at the time, because I didn't feel engaged. Engaged to me felt like a happy thing, whereas a betrothal felt like an arrangement, and it felt like an arrangement to me. I wasn't asked. I was just told. And the clincher, of course, was, and I've spoken about this before, so spoiler alert, but also not so spoiler alert, the purity culture setup in the books on purity culture and courtship versus dating all say that you'll know when you've met the one, even though you don't date them, because God's going to affirm it through your spiritual elders, through your pastors and your parents, primarily, if you have godly parents. I did have very godly parents, and so did the guy. And both my dad and the guy's mom affirmed that they too had heard from God that we were going to get married. And so, my world was both going right on track and completely upside down. Cause on the outside, my betrothal happened like to the T, like we weren't going to kiss till our wedding day. It just couldn't have been more book perfect. But on the inside was just, I was wrestling with so much betrayal and guilt and anger and guilt for feeling angry and betrayed and trying to force myself to be grateful, you know, like just be grateful, submit. And I did my best. I did my best. And it lasted 2 months before my mom, who had stopped going to church by that point, was the one who could see that I was deeply unhappy and gave me the courage to eventually break it off. And it was just the scariest thing that I'd ever done, because,
well, it's not like, just a breakup. It's almost turning your back on God in an emotional sense.
That's very much what it felt like to me. And also turning my face toward Satan, because if you weren't in alignment with God, there was only one other alignment you could be in, and that was that of the devil and hell. So it was, for me, it was not just breaking up with a guy that I wasn't even in love with. It wasn't just turning my back on God and walking away from the ideology that had guided my entire life thus far. It was also for the first time being like, Satan, come get me. You're going to get me now. I just know it, because I'd been indoctrinated with the belief that when we disobey God, even though he gave us free will to disobey him, we opened ourselves up to eternal destruction, and to being the devil's plaything. And God would forgive us if we'd go back in alignment with God. But if we didn't, then we were, you know, like Satan was free to have at us. So without God's protection. And so what followed for me was just like my first crisis of faith, my first year of, and I write about this too, about how that's, around a year or so after I ended the betrothal was when I realized that I'd ended my relationship with God in an evangelical sense. I still very much believed in God. And then I also had met some very liberal Christians out here in LA who,
no way.
Yeah. And they baffled me. And to be honest with you, they still baffle me for some different reasons. Sure. We've all learned to like some of my closest friends, are identify as Christian or are deeply spiritual or use the language of Jesus. And we, I'm very lucky to have in my life people who can tolerate my bafflement and genuine questions. Like, but how, when you haven't actually read what Jesus said, do you call yourself Christian? Like, I try to be nice about it, but at the end of the day, it's like, I don't get it, guys. I don't get it. but you know, everyone, I'm a huge advocate for free speech. And so if someone wants to call themselves something and it means something different to them than it does to me, good, go for it. Cause I'm going to call myself something that means something different to me than it does to you, whether it's atheist or something else.
I don't know if you've seen this, but there are like YouTube channels with young women who are still advocating purity culture. And part of that baffles my mind because I feel like so many Christians who grew up in that environment have had the courage to speak out about the harm, not even saying, you know, like, go run wild, it's good for you. That's not what they're saying. They're saying, listen, you don't have to take this by the letter. Like kissing someone you genuinely like, trust me, not the end of the world. They've been very outspoken about that and the harm that the purity culture movement kind of caused them. But there are still people out there pushing that wait till your wedding day, till you do anything, and you will know it in your heart if God is sending you a message. Have you seen any of those? And like, do you watch any of those and like want to scream at the computer? Or I don't know if you've seen any of those since then.
I haven't come across too many. There are a couple accounts on Instagram that I follow that are more post purity culture that occasionally will post about these present day, like revised purity culture advocates. And it kind of, I feel grateful to be at a place now where it kind of just gives me a chuckle instead of getting me worked up again. Cause there was definitely a time where I would have gotten really worked up because I would have still felt threatened that they were right. And that's just why I would have gotten worked up. But I think now it's just like, oh man, like I see, and I have conflicted feelings about this, but to my observation, there's a huge revival, if you will, of like what I call like a Christianity inspired spiritual movement, where people who are not biblically literate but are still using the brand of Christianity to incorporate in their spiritual practice and spiritual ideals. It's confusing to me. And at the same time, I'm kind of grateful for it because it is a lot more accepting and open-minded and LGBTQ affirming than certainly the type of Christianity I grew up with. But there's still, for me, on a philosophical and logical standpoint, doesn't make sense to my mind, but it doesn't need to. It makes sense to theirs. And I consider them allies because they can use the language to speak to the more hardcore evangelical leaning people.
That's one thing you get from your book, which is you can't doubt the fact that you were devout, that you grew up a Christian. Like, no, you are very much steeped in Christianity for such a long part of your life. You know what you're talking about when you're saying this stuff. That makes a difference. Yeah. You also said it wasn't just the purity culture thing. You also read a lot of like the James Dobson books.
Yes.
Growing up too. What sort of influence was that for you?
For me, the whole focus on the Family Institute, with James Dobson, like it influenced the movies I watched. I wasn't allowed to read secular magazines. I got Guideposts for Teens, which is like, I was like, my sex education was a book by Dr. James Dobson called Preparing for Adolescence. And it was, I read about it.
Which is where everyone should get all their sex advice from.
I write in the book how it's like I learned about masturbation through that book. And like it was so confusing because Dr. Dobson wrote that, you know, you shouldn't feel ashamed if you masturbate, but I'm going to leave that between you and God, basically.
I was surprised when you said that. I'm like, he said that? Really? Oh, interesting.
Kind of comes across as a little more progressive for like an ultra conservative Christian doctor.
It really does. Yeah.
But at first I was like, oh, like there's this thing called masturbation. Cool. Oh, he seems to support it. But then there was that little line of like, but you know, everyone should really prayerfully consider this and it's between you and God. And I was like, oh man, but like lust is definitely wrong. And I don't know how to masturbate without also having lustful thoughts. So it must just be wrong.
Or maybe God's sending a message. Who knows?
Yeah. Who knows?
But you mentioned that he influenced the pop culture you consumed. I think you said your parents forbade you from any of that pop culture stuff. It was really surprising that they were relatively fine with you modeling, with you trying out for going to Hollywood, period.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I'm wondering how much of that scene, how much of Hollywood, like, did you even know what Hollywood meant in a sense? Because you were basically told, don't consume anything that comes from there.
Yeah. I was allowed to watch like Disney movies and sure. some movies that were rated G, but even some G rated animated cartoon movies, like I wasn't allowed to see Fern Gully because it was demonic. I wasn't, you know, like it was very selective at my parents' discretion, what would be okay and what would not be. So no, I'm woefully to this day behind the times of what someone in my profession should know about the classics, about the history of certain actors and acting techniques, and just like classics. Like I've still never seen the movie Grease, for instance. And like, I'm not a singer, I don't do musicals, but like I should see that. Like
there's a Reddit, there's a subreddit called Nostalgia, where it's a lot of people who are like in their 30s and 40s saying, remember this from our childhood? And I wonder how much of that you would see now. And be like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, I remember on Facebook, there'd be these things going around like, you know, you're a 90s kid if, and like, mm-hmm. I must not have been a 90s kid because I don't live any of the things like, and it's fun. I particularly enjoy when I come across like, you know, you're an ex-evangelical if, because I can relate to all those. Sure. I even wrote on the Dare to Doubt blog a little bit a while ago, but anyway, it's I had a lot of catching up to do. I still do. It will always be kind of an amazement to me that my parents were as supportive as they were. But one of the reasons that I'm grateful for, and that helps clarify it for me, and that I'm happy to be able to say, is my parents change a lot too. I think there were several periods in my childhood where they were deeply involved in one type of Christianity, and then deeply involved in another, deeply involved in no organized religion at all, and then deeply involved in a more metaphysical curiosity thing. Like they're very evolving people. And for all of the frustrations that I definitely had growing up with them, like I do today very much appreciate that my parents are always open to change and always open to growing and being challenged. And I think by the time I was 17 and moving to LA, they were not in the same place spiritually that they were when I was 9 and 10 and we were involved in the Toronto Blessing. So I think had I been 17 in the mid 90s, my parents probably might not have been as supportive of me moving to LA and pursuing modeling and acting, but it was like the early 2000s and their faith had evolved by then as well. And so I think that definitely contributes to them being so supportive of me.
I want to bring up Dare to Doubt since you mentioned it, but before I do that, really quick, you wrote about a pastor named Rodney Howard Brown and these Holy Laughter revivals. And I don't know if you're aware of why he's been in the news lately as well, because he's still doing that. And I've seen those videos, and they are Holy Laughter revivals. You can imagine it. It's that. But he also, I was wondering if you were watching the news, because he was one of the first pastors to really get arrested this year for trying to keep his church open during the pandemic, I think in Tampa, Florida. And I don't know if like, I had not really heard his name that much until the pandemic happened.
Yes. No, it was, It was both surprising and not surprising to see his name making headlines again this past spring regarding the pandemic and his flouting of the regulations to get his congregants together. Rodney Howard Brown was a celebrity in my childhood, but he's a very niche pastor in the real
world.
He
really is, yeah. That's why it shook me to see his name. I understood James Dobson being in your book, but I was like, whoa, Rodney Howard Brown. Like, that's a name I have not heard in memoirs about people leaving Christianity ever.
Yeah. So it's so interesting. We all grow up in our little bubbles, and there's these like famous people in our little bubbles, right? And like there were several in mine. Like some of them are a little bit more well known, like Lou Engel, who did The Call in DC, The Call, it's called The Call, everywhere. He worked his way quite high up the U.S. politician ladder in the Republican Party.
You're doing the Seven Dominions, or what am I thinking of? Dominionism or something, Seven Mountains, something like that. I can't remember if that's Lou Engle, but yeah.
So the church that I went to that he came and visited had a school within the church called Dominion. I'm very familiar with Dominionism, Christian nationalism, all of that. And that was like another chapter of my migratory upbringing. But yeah, there are some of my childhood celebrities that are more also publicly known, like Rodney Howard Brown for getting arrested for holding church pandemic, or Lou Engle, who's gotten a little bit of press for, you know, being very tight with a lot of Christian right politicians. But some of them are also just still pretty niche, like John Arnott, who was the lead pastor of the Toronto Airport Christian Fellowship, which is where the Toronto Blessing was birthed. But yeah, Rodney Howard Brown, man, seeing that guy's face still after all these years, elicits a physical response.
I can imagine. If you get a chance to search for his laughter revivals and you don't know what we're talking about, you should look that up. And one other thing I wanted to bring up is you watched the movie Jesus Camp and also talked about having like a almost physical revulsion to do it to it. Can you talk about that really quick?
Yes, I started watching it. I got maybe 10 minutes into the film, 10, 15 minutes into the film, and I couldn't finish that movie until years later, because when I first came across it, I believe I was 20 and I was still very much a believer. I still very much believed in God, still called myself a Christian / follower of Christ at that point, because I was starting to segue into progressive Christianity and just didn't like the label of Christian. So I was questioning, but still very much a believer. And I didn't like thinking about my past. I didn't like thinking about my upbringing. It always brought on more questions that I didn't know how to answer, like my first day at school. What my boyfriend at the time put on Jesus Camp, and it opens with this children's pastor praying for a bunch of these kids who all start praying in tongues, and their hands are up and they're like crying and the spotlights are hitting their faces in the auditorium. And it was all so familiar to me. And I couldn't understand the emotional reaction that I was having. What I know now is that I was, I was triggered. You know, it put me right back in that place of thinking, I have to give these adults the performance expected of me.
You were one of those kids.
I was one of those kids. The documentary went on and brought in Lou Engle too. It shows Lou Engle. And I was looking for I would like pause and look for myself in the crowd, because I was so sure I would see myself, because it was like, I remember this. I remember I could have been there. Was it this conference? I don't know, because I was so steeped in it. And it makes me feel hot right now, even remembering that, because it was so surreal to have had some distance from that chapter of my life, to be so confronted with it and to see it from a much more evolved perspective of like, what the fuck was that? Mm-hmm. Pardon my language if this is a non-language.
Oh, it's a rated G show. So yeah, no, you're fine. You're fine. But I understand that reaction. I mean, it's a very, it seems, I think, to a lot of outsiders, like, okay, fundamentalist Christian camp. Okay. I mean, this is what I expect, but surely this is only these people. It doesn't seem like necessarily it's this big movement. Except it really is. There's a lot of kids who went through that and dealt with that. And I think even some of the kids in that movie have publicly said, we have since left that.
Oh, that's news to me. I'm going to have to.
Yeah. Wow. I think The Guardian did like a 10-year retrospective after the movie came out, because those kids are probably what, in their 20s now, early 20s. And yeah, a number of them are like, they're in the same position you're in, where they're like, yeah, I went through that and I have since left. And so there's hope. There's like at the end of the tunnel there. Can you talk about Dare to Doubt and why you started it and what you're hoping to do with it?
I started Dare to Doubt for these kids, like myself. I started it for me, first and foremost. I wanted to make a resource site for I did this 2 years ago, and I set out to make the website that I needed when I was 21 and really just falling apart following my loss of faith. And I really needed therapy. I was in therapy for 3 years. I had crippling panic attacks after I lost my faith. And I didn't really attribute it to the loss of my faith as the reason why. But long story short, all my shit hit the fan. I fell apart completely, lost all my marbles, really needed a lot of professional help putting myself back together. Would later come to learn about religious trauma syndrome, how it often mimics complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And panic attacks are totally normal when you have a loss of faith. And so I wanted to make a website that would make it easier for people like my younger self to find the help that they needed. And for me, the help that I needed was definitely secular. I was leery. When I lost my faith, I lost it in full. I couldn't just rebrand God in my mind. I tried for a couple years. I really tried, but the Bible and the theology itself was just, it was just not logical enough for me.
It was kind of an all or nothing thing. You had the Christianity you grew up with, or that was it. There wasn't like a middle compromise ground there.
There wasn't. And again, you know, like I think I can be like that in many ways, like very, and some people have said, oh, that's because, you know, it's your fundamentalist black and white thinking. And it's like, maybe, but it doesn't matter to me. If it doesn't hold up, it doesn't hold up. And I'm tired of making justifications for why it should. Because God was just never real to me. He was very real to me as an idea, but never real to me personally. And I respect that he, she, they, them, it are to some on an experiential level that I will never understand or be able to participate in. But it, bottom line, God just wasn't real to me. And I was fiercely allergic to the slightest hint of faith. I met with some therapists out here in LA who were possibly what you might call spiritual. I called them spiritual. They're into like things like meditation. To me, I'm now at a place where I can think of meditation in a sort of secular sense. Like I know Sam Harris, one of our most atheists of today, is very into meditation, and I've done some of his guided meditations to try to re-experiment with it. But to this day, it still is a button for me. It just feels too much like prayer, and like nothing happens. Like, well, it's about the discipline. It's about the discipline. I'm like, yeah, that's what they said about prayer too, though, guys. Like, it's just not my thing.
It is really hard. I've heard from a lot of people who said when they were looking for therapists, they trying to find someone who could not see their loss of faith as a bad thing and just kind of accept it and be coming to therapy from a secular perspective is important to them. There's actually, I believe this is a group called Recovering from Religion. They actually have a project called the Secular Therapist Project for exactly the reason you're mentioning, because you want someone who's going to go from there and then help you from that baseline, not try to make you feel bad for being non-religious.
Yes, yes. And it's organizations like that that I really wanted to help spread awareness of. And there's others, like there's AA, a secular AA meetings. You know, there's so many resources out there that I'd never heard of until I started building the site. And not just for ex-Christians, but ex-Amish people, ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, ex, you know, like Scientologists. And I kind of wanted to make a site that offered just a starting point. It's not thorough. There are so many organizations out there and therapists and peer support.
The links are really helpful. Like you're saying, there are specific websites for like the ex-Amish, the ex-Orthodox Jewish people. Mm-hmm. Like those are there, but this is a good generic kind of starting point for so many people. The website there is daretodoubt.org. And Alice Gretchen, her new book is called Wave Word. You should check it out. I'm not kidding when I say it's a really well-written, heartbreaking at times, but also really uplifting book about what it means to leave religion and the difficulty that may be, but also that you can come out fine on the other side. So congratulations on your new book. People should check it out. And thank you for your time. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it too.